The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. And David, before we go to our guest, Charles Vollen, we met him a couple of years ago in the Bahamas. Fascinating guy. He lives on a sailboat with his family for part of the year. And then, of course, he has other residences around the world. But he's fascinating because he actually prices things the way we all should price things. You know, before 1971, things were priced in gold because the dollar was priced in gold. But then we went off the gold standard, and somehow, some way, we just blindly continued to act like the dollar was some sort of pseudo gold.
With that different starting point, you see the world in a radically different way. What is overpriced? What is underpriced? I think this is where he sort of breaks the monotony of dollar pricing and says, yeah, we've lost our way if we assume that something that is literally all over the map is somehow a constant. This is where your education begins in earnest. I would suggest that this is one of the most compelling commentaries we've ever done. And I say that because I think for those who will listen, those who will work through what we're about to discuss, you'll be able to mark this down as a turning point in your stewardship of assets. And we're going to start with something that's slightly off center. Assumptions are absolutely critical. Assumptions about the money we use are even more so. When we consider the most basic characteristics of money, we look at them as a means of exchange. We look at money as a store of value. And these are the things that you assume about our money system. And we live as if our money has a constant value and prices are moving up and down all around that constant. I mean, you probably heard yourself say gas is getting expensive, or very recently, food seems to keep going up in price, all of which is a fair assessment if our money is a constant. And this is where I think when we look back in time, we say, yes, it once was a constant, but under a fiat system, the system that we have today, we would be incorrect in assuming anything of a stable store of value, in greenbacks in particular. Now, I began thinking about relative values years ago, that the stock market and gold was a topic of conversation, dinner conversation in our house all growing up. Then in 2003, my family sold our house in Southern California, and we made a choice to add significantly to a gold position. The idea at the time was that gold seemed very cheap, and housing both in California and in Colorado, where we had just moved to, was very expensive, again, relatively speaking. And the relative price seemed compelling. That's why we moved into gold at the time. We rented for 7 years before moving from ounces back into a home. Now, I met Sir Charles for a very mind-expanding exploration of the application of sort of pricing things in gold, I would say 3 years ago, and have been sort of radically reassessing everything under the sun, not just the stock market, not just housing, but you could look at Yale University education, natural gas, crude oil, copper, coffee, food, platinum, palladium, you know, the gross domestic product of the United States. You name it, you price it in gold, and it gives you a very different basis for understanding long-term trends. And I think this is what we have lost over, I don't know what kind of a time frame, probably since 71 most decidedly, and it's not without coincidence. Charles de Gaulle said at that time, there can be no other criterion, no other standard than gold. Yes, gold, which never changes, which can be turned into ingots, bars, and coins, which has no nationality, and which is eternally and universally accepted as an unalterable fiduciary value par excellence. Sir Charles, when we look at relative values, instead of sort of the absolute pricing we're used to, nominal pricing we're used to, there is more to the story. And I'd like for you to kind of expand our minds a little bit. How did you come about seeing the world through this particular lens? It's an old lens. It was actually the common lens that people looked through, but no longer. How can we rediscover that?
Wow. It's something that I came to kind of gradually. I started thinking about the fact that prices move relative to one another, and I was looking at gold, and I thought of gold as an investment, something that I was buying because I thought it was undervalued and would go up. But the more I started looking at gold and stocks and houses and other kinds of things, the more I thought, you know, actually, these things tend to go up together often and down together often. And I started thinking, well, why is that? What's the common thing between these? And then I realized at some point that that common thing was the dollar. These things are being priced, both being priced in dollars. And if you factored the dollar out and you just said, well, how many ounces of gold does it take to buy the Dow or whatever you're looking at, actually volatility goes down. And not only does volatility go down, but this sort of long-term trend upward in, for example, the prices of stocks or homes or food or gas or whatever, disappears. And prices, well, they certainly vary around relative to gold, because sometimes people would prefer to have gold, and other times they'd prefer to have gasoline or food or stocks or whatever, depending on their particular situation. But nonetheless, those variations are much flatter, and they don't have that long-term upward tilt to them that they have when you measure them in dollars. And it just suddenly made sense to me that, gosh, our money is being manipulated. I mean, the Fed exists to control, manipulate, set the value of the dollar. That's its job. And it does that with lots of different tools. It creates new money. It can, you know, buy assets with that money. So it can use that to push the value of the dollar relative to other things around. It can control interest rates, which is, you know, the return on holding those dollars. So it can make them more or less attractive. It can do all kinds of things, but all of the things that it does affect primarily the relative value of the dollar itself. So, gosh, it would be so neat if we could factor all that out and just look at the actual values of the underlying stuff without the distortions that the Fed is creating for its own purposes. And I don't know, one day it just kind of clicked with me that that's really the thing that I need to be doing. And you're absolutely right. Prior to 1971, although people didn't hold and trade, I mean, they didn't have gold basically in their physical possession, the dollars on an international basis were all exchangeable for gold. And so it really, there was an active kind of feedback loop going there to force the value of the dollar to a pretty close ratio with gold. And when Nixon gave that up, then that's, if you look on almost any chart of things relative to gold, they're pretty calm and more or less what you'd expect up until the early 70s. And then all hell breaks loose and prices start going all over the place. And that's really reflecting the fact that there was a lot of pent-up distortion in the value of the dollar itself, that the Fed had been working extremely hard to try to force the value of the dollar to be equal to 1/35th of an ounce of gold, even though we were printing massive amounts of money for the war in Vietnam and, you know, the guns and butter programs and all these the things that were coming online from the 60s and the 70s. Though they were trying as hard as they could to force the value of the dollar to stay at $35 an ounce, despite all of that. And when they finally gave it up, it just went wild and rapidly, you know, kind of probably overshot its or undershot its value, and then it slammed back this way and that way. And in 1980, you had a really high price in gold, and then you had gold falling. And as the market kind of readjusted itself and found a reasonable level for these things, and then we've sort of seen what we've seen since, which has been a massive expansion in the number of dollars and a massive decline in the value of each individual dollar. But prices in gold have, you know, they've kind of drifted around higher and lower. And right now, many things are very low in terms of their price in gold. So we may be reaching a point, I think undoubtedly we will reach a point in the not too distant future where the prices of lots of things are rising with respect to gold. But we're not there yet, I don't think.
Yeah, looking at charts, you can see how inflationary the trend has been on an accelerated basis since 1971. It just so happens that the Fed was created in 1913. We're at the 100-year anniversary. So if you wanted to skip back 100 years, in essence, the increases we've seen in various asset classes, what you're describing, when you look at a chart and you see an increase in the average single-family home, an increase in the Dow, an increase in the S&P, and what have you, it really is driven by money printing more than any single factor. What you're basically saying is if you take out the money printing, you do see volatility in these asset classes, and sometimes they're overvalued and sometimes they're undervalued relative to a constant. I mean, is it fair to say that you should stay in cash a good bit of the time. Just choose the right denomination. Gold being the old version of cash.
Yeah, I mean, I think gold is kind of the ultimate version of cash. So if you go back 100 years, and or back to 1900 or 19, I'd say 100 years, I don't know, the early 1900s, around the time before the time of the Fed, and you take the money then that people had in their pockets, if they had $20, it was could have been a $20 gold piece, or it could have been two $10 gold pieces, or four or $5 gold pieces, or it could have been a piece of paper that said, there is deposit on deposit in the Treasury of the United States, $20 in gold payable to the bearer on demand. And you had a piece of paper, you could take it into any bank, and they would give you the $20 gold piece. So the piece of paper really was as good as gold. It was a gold certificate. Or you could have a silver certificate, so it'll give you 20 silver dollars. But even the paper money was really a stand-in for the metal money. And if you took that $20 gold piece, which was around an ounce of gold, and you put it into a safe somewhere, you could come back in 100 years, and you would still have roughly an ounce of gold. You'd have that gold piece would still be there. If the bank that gave you the gold piece might have failed during the Great Depression, or been gobbled up by some other banks and kind of disappeared, or you know, there's no intermediary between you and your money. Your money is the $20 gold piece, and it sits in your safe. So there's no counterparty risk with holding that form of cash. You have the money. It's done. All you have to do is worry about somebody taking it away from you. And, you know, that's always a concern, but that isn't the fault of the money. That's just a matter of, you know, you protecting your assets. But it can't be inflated away. No government edict can cause that 1 ounce of gold to be anything other than what it is, 1 ounce of gold. And so it's a very safe form of money. Now, it has a little bit of a cost to holding it because you have to put it somewhere safe, maybe insure it if you're worried about that, especially if somebody else is, if you're putting it in a vault somewhere else, you might want some insurance to be sure if the building burns down or something, you're covered. But basically, the cost of holding it is very low. It doesn't change, though. It doesn't grow in any way. It doesn't pay any interest. You know, Warren Buffett's right about the fact that gold is just a big lump of metal. It doesn't do anything for anybody. It's not an investment. It's just a way of holding cash. And on the other hand, there's lots of things that you could trade that gold for that could go up in value. So those things are investments or speculations. I mean, depending on how well you understand them and how, you know, what their pattern of return is, if you're just sort of hoping that they're going to go up in value, then it's more of a speculation. If it's something that's earning a regular stream of income and paying you, and its value is something that's easy to understand and business model you can understand, then maybe it really is a true investment. And those things can grow in gold value. So if you take that $20 gold piece and you buy a share of a company that you understand that's got a good business, then a few years later, you might be able to sell that share of company for the company for 2 ounces of gold, enough dollars to buy 2 ounces of gold. Then you've grown your gold through that investment. And so I don't think of gold itself as an investment. It's a form of cash. And sometimes it's wise to be in cash. When everything is falling and the markets are crazy and everybody's panicking, you want to be in cash. But a lot of the time, you want to be in things that are going to be growing your gold value.
You and I look at the charts that are on your website, pricedingold.com, an amazing resource, something that should be listed on the favorites on everyone's laptop or CPU. It's very important that you spend some time looking through, and what you will find is that whether it's natural gas over the last, not just 4 or 5, but even 10, 15, 20 years, crude oil, an interesting trend, copper, you know, going back, whether it's 10 years or 100 years, you see this declining value. And right now we are getting to very cheap values in gold terms for everything under the sun, coffee, food. You know, to have a discussion with my wife about how cheap food is, she says, no, that's not the case. If there's anything under the sun that I would complain about most, it's the high cost of food and how little we're getting for the same dollars we used to spend. And I explained that's the impact of inflation. It takes more money to buy the same things.
Yep.
And in a deflationary environment, or with a deflationary money system, if you will, your money buys more and more over time. And that's what we've lost in moving to an entirely fiat system. It will inexorably take more and more currency units to buy the same stuff. It's not the real story in terms of value. And if you have denominated your cash, your savings in the right denomination, then what you're looking at is values we haven't seen in a long time. I'm fascinated, and I've used this in a presentation before. What about a Yale University education? It seems like $48,000 is a lot to pay, close to $50,000 per semester or per year. Is it really that expensive?
Yeah, that's one of the ones that really shocked me. Somebody wrote and asked me about college education, and I started doing some research. I picked Yale because there's this resource called the Yale Book of Numbers that goes back to, like, the, I don't know if it goes clear back to the founding, but it goes way back before 1900, where they keep all kinds of statistics about Yale University and the costs of various things and the numbers of students and what they were doing, all this data. So I was fortunate enough to be able to scan back and pull out numbers going, I made my chart start at 1900 just to give it a nice clean starting point, and compare that with, you know, gold. How many grams of gold did it take to pay for a college tuition, room and board? They break it all out. I just combined it to make a nice single number. And back in 1900, it was just a little over 1 kilogram of gold. And at that time, of course, it wasn't, every ounce is like 30, so that would be like something like 30 ounces or about $600 in $20 gold pieces. And, you know, it's stayed pretty much the same. It went down a little bit going into the 20s, and then it started to rise. It kind of hit a high point in the very early 30s, and then during the Depression, the price went down. It went down from like 1,500 to 1,000. So it was a pretty big price drop, actually, during the Depression, and it kind of was at a fairly low level during the later 1930s. And during World War II, it started to rise a little bit. In the 50s and 60s, it rose quite a lot. It had doubled to 2 kilograms by 1960 and hit about, I don't know, 3.4 kilograms in 1970s, just before we went off the gold standard. And then, of course, it crashed along with everything else as the dollar started seeking its proper value. I think actually the actual fact is that the 1970s high was probably an overstatement because of manipulation by the Fed, and then the resulting 1980s low is kind of an understatement, again, because the market was trying to seek its level. And it's had some wild swings since then, but now it's back to a little over 1 kilogram, maybe 1.25. It's been rising slightly in the last, say, year or two. But basically, it's not that different from what it was back in 1900. And I suspect if you were saving for a good high-quality education for a child, and you're looking out 10, 15 years, whatever, and if you were to think in your mind, well, I've got to set aside money for this. If I set aside around 1 kilogram or maybe a little bit more of gold, chances are very good that it will be really close to paying what's going to be necessary. And now that might be $500,000, or it might be a few thousand dollars, depending on what happens to the value of the dollar in the meantime. Of course, dollars themselves may not even be accepted 10 years from now. Who knows? We may have gone on to some other kind of currency. But I suspect that that kilogram or kilogram and a half, whatever number you kind of put in your mind, but something in that vicinity will probably be exchangeable at that time for whatever money is appropriate to buy a year's worth of college tuition.
Charles, you just described maintaining purchasing power. I mean, and this is, I think, what is so basic and maybe underappreciated about gold. That's its primary purpose, is to maintain purchasing power. There's certain periods of time where it will actually increase in terms of your purchasing power. And it's those periods of time where you don't want to own gold as much anymore, because there are better values out there. Essentially, moving out of cash, the values become so compelling that you should be considering either other investments, other speculations, other venues for your resources.
Exactly. Well, there's sort of two components to everybody's investments, whatever you want to call them, assets. And you do want to have cash. You always want to have cash. You never want to go all in on some wild speculation. You need cash. You need it to operate, you know, pay your daily bills. And you need a cushion, a reserve of money that's there no matter what happens to the other things you're trying to do. Because sometimes those things don't work out through no fault of your own because of lots of different reasons. There's all kinds of reasons. You have to be prepared with a cushion that you can fall back on to keep your family safe and care for them, and to give yourself another start if some things don't work out, so that you have some assets that you can deploy to begin anew. And that sort of cash cushion is something that, that preference for cash is something that varies throughout time. It depends a lot on the economy and how well, you know, how many jobs there are, what sort of the quality of the earnings that you can make at your job are, the state of, as you say, the undervalued or overvalued nature of the various investment options that are available. You're always looking through the options and trying to sift to some balance, some mix, which makes sense at the time, and sort of what that level, what those levels are, does change over time. And there's a high preference for cash in times when things are tight and jobs are hard to get. And, you know, sometimes people want to have the safety and security of knowing that their money is safe and it's theirs and it's sort of it's there. They want to grow that cash pile. And other times it makes more sense to put it out there, get it to work for you, get it growing. You're taking risk when you do that, but at the same time, you're opening yourself up to possible gains. And so I think gold, as the best ultimate form of cash, really wants to form the kind of the core of that savings that you have. But how big that pool of savings wants to be, whether you should be all in cash because it's 29 and you really want to be out of all these markets and you want to have your money where you can keep your hands on it, then you may want to have a lot of your money in gold. On the other hand, when things are booming, you really want to be investing in things that are going to grow the amount of gold that you have access to. So that trade-off is kind of an ebb and flow that's always going to be there. But I don't see gold as an inflation hedge where you hold a little of it because it'll go up and make up for your losses everywhere else. And I don't see it as an investment. I see holding U.S. dollars as a speculation. You may think that for some reason, because the way the world economy is working, people are very concerned about other currencies. They're all rushing into the dollar for safety, as they perceive it. And that can push the value of dollars up. And that's what's happened recently. The dollar has become very strong compared to a lot of things, including gold. So you can make money by buying dollars. But when you do that, you're taking a real risk to hold a lot of dollars because, you know, the dollar is a very volatile commodity, in my opinion. And it's hard to know. These things can turn on a dime. Suddenly people can say, holy moly, look at this deficit we've got. And look at these. The student loan bubble could implode or whatever. And all of a sudden, dollars could become anathema. And everybody wants out of them. They're looking for anything that they can get into that gets them out of dollars. And then the dollar value relative to these other things is going to collapse. So I don't see holding large amounts of dollar cash as a very safe thing, but it can be a very lucrative speculation sometimes. But gold is more the core.
You know, when you see the relationships that you have and the charts that you've constructed, it's over a course of time that these relationships are clarified. And it's a little bit like relationships that we have. If you've been married for a matter of weeks or months, there's a lot that may have occurred, but not a whole lot that has changed in a very short period of time. You step back and look at a 50-year relationship and you see the seasons of life. You've got recollections of being young, married with no children, married with children, grown children, grandchildren, you know, or even through a different looking glass altogether. You know, your career, the early career stages, the middle career, the end of your career, retirement. The point being that time factors into the relief, allowing for contrast, allowing for reflection, and frankly, aiding in the navigation of what is happening in gold terms. And when you're looking at investing, I think the curse of our day is that people focus on a day, focus on a week, they focus on a month, even a year, when reality shifts over a longer period of time. Relational shifts between asset classes take years and in some cases even decades. And, you know, I think one of the things that I've appreciated in knowing you the last few years is that it's an issue of stewardship. And I think stewards guide that process of allocation on a non-time constrained basis. Looking at the charts, all of a sudden the world comes alive to me, as I'm sure it has to you, and I really appreciate you facilitating all of this through PricedInGold.com. But what you begin to see is there are times that you do want to have more cash, /gold, or less in other things, but you're not constrained by time. You take away the pressure and the emotion of financial decisions, and it becomes a very dispassionate intergenerational process.
Yeah, I think on Price and Gold, that probably as an investor, one of the things that's helped me the most is when I started keeping these charts, I realized that pricing things in gold really makes the most sense over the longest time period. So the longer the time period you're looking at, the more sense it makes. Because, you know, let's face it, the bullion banks and the feds, or they can come in and push the price around for a day or two or a week or a month or even a year. They can sustain losses to, you know, push against the market to force the price. In the case of the dollar being $35 an ounce or 1/35th of an ounce, they did that for a long time, for decades. And it was probably fairly natural at the beginning, but it became more and more forced towards the end. So there are tremendous resources that can push things around for extended periods, but as the time periods get longer, things tend to even out, and these sort of perturbations, whether they're market excitements and panics, or whether they're actually caused by some kind of manipulation, they eventually, the forces of nature move things, the market forces move things into their appropriate balance over time. And so, of course, it's nice to be able to take advantage of a dislocation that is happening at the moment for some reason. But when you're looking at sort of the overall sweep of things, I think the longer time periods, the better. And so on my site, about the shortest chart I have is 3.5 years long. I have a few things that I chart from 2010, but most of them I chart from 2006. So we're talking about, well, more than 5 years, 6, 7, 8 years. And many of them are much longer than that. I try to take them back as far as I can, often to 1900 or to the 1970s, because the 70s are really, from that point forward, is where most of the action comes, because the prices were more free-floating. So when I look at these long-term sort of sweeps, it's different from when you look at a short-term chart of the last 3 months, or if you look at a daily chart or a weekly chart with all kinds of noise and activity in it. Those are useful, and I think you can derive benefit from them if you have that kind of trader mentality and a feeling and an understanding for markets. But that's a very specialized thing. It's not really investment in the sense of trying to, as you say, maintain a stewardship with respect to your investment. That's a very different kind of economic activity, trading and arbitraging and looking for those disparities and taking advantage of them in a fairly quick way is a totally different economic activity from trying to decide on overall allocations and trying to move your wealth, preserve it, and grow it over time in a kind of a stewardship way, as you say. I think those things need a much longer time frame. And one of the things that this maintaining this site has done for me is I look at these things every day, but when I look at them, I tend to look at the charts, and the charts always put me into this longer time frame view. And I found that to be very useful for myself, because it's psychologically calming to sort of take the day-to-day noise out of the picture. In some ways, I think my best investing in the past was done where I didn't look at all for extended periods at what the market was doing, and just checked in, you know, once a month or once a quarter, or when I was sailing, even over the course of a year, not really looking at things very much because I didn't have access to information. I mean, I made my best guesses and then sort of set it and forget it and came back later. And in general, things worked out very well for me. So I think looking at the longer time frame is really important. It's calming, and it sort of says, well, okay, everybody's panicking. You read these things in the news. I try to not to read that much news even, because it's so much of it is just noise. It pushes people's emotional buttons, but doesn't really have anything to do with the true underlying values of any of this stuff.
You know, many of the charts that you show, again, have values relative to gold, and they appear to be nearing a turning point in the markets where deploying cash or gold into other assets will make sense. Maybe I can prepay Yale tuition today for 10 years from now.
I don't know, but you can certainly buy some gold for it.
Well, maybe you can speak to the math involved in what appears to be small moves on the charts, you know, that you've drawn, but these small root moves, sort of the remaining stretch. I mean, I'll just give you an example. You look at U.S. disposable income or the Dow gold ratio. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground going from 43, 44 ounces of gold to one share of the Dow, now to about 10 or 11 to 1. Arguably, there's not much left in terms of this move, and yet there is an interesting mathematical relationship. Not much left, but a whole lot left. Maybe you can explore that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if you look at that chart, let's take the Dow because it's a convenient one. There's a chart on my website for the Dow going back to 1900, and I do it in grams of gold just because I find it easier to think in gram numbers, but obviously the prices in ounces, the same sort of thing. When you see 31 grams, that's the same as 1 ounce. So over and over again, the Dow has been at that sort of in that vicinity of 1 ounce, of 30 to 50 grams. And, you know, it was that way in the early 1900s, and then at the bottom in the 1930s, and then again in 1980. And today, we're not anywhere close to, let's say, 50 grams. We're, you know, 250, something like that. So there's a long way down from 250 to 50, but it's also, you know, that doesn't mean it is quite low now, actually, compared to historical averages. We're in the sort of bottom area of the chart, but there could still be a long way down from 250 to 50. And in grams, or I guess that'd be 5 ounces to 1 ounce, or let's say just in rough ounce numbers. So, you know, you could lose 80% from here to get back to the old bottoms that occurred at the other low points on the chart going back to 1900. Now, there's nothing that says we have to. We don't have to revisit those levels necessarily, but it's certainly, I wouldn't take it off the table at all. It's definitely a possibility. And, you know, right now, for the last 18 months, we've kind of been in an updraft, even with respect to gold and the Dow, but we're kind of nearing what I would draw, if you could draw a line across this chart. There's sort of in the area where we are, there's a number of points where it's peaked or had resistance there before. And so we may be getting near one of those, you know, then maybe this will be another turnaround and we'll move lower. Some people are predicting lower market. I don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but it certainly technically would make some sense from where we are. But I don't know. You know, nobody knows the future. We can say that we're in the lower part of the historical average, but we're nowhere near the bottom.
You know, it seems like what most investors want is definition, something determined, something guaranteed. And life doesn't really work that way. Life is full of uncertainties. It's full of ambiguities. And relationships, frankly, are in that same mix of things that are constantly changing. You know, so we think of relative valuations as maybe offering guidelines more than hard and fast rules. And when you say, well, you know, Dow gold ratio could go lower, meaning gold price is higher relative to stocks, but it may not. It doesn't have to do that. You're kind of expressing that same issue of, well, this is where these are not scientific rules. These are not natural rules that have to be axiomatic in some way. We will see this. We may not, but we do over a course of time begin to see valuations and how they compare relative to one another, whether it is the S&P, whether it is the Toronto Stock Exchange. When you look at all the charts that you put out there, where to you do you find compelling value today? You know, you've got your cash position in ounces, and, you know, is there a reason why you should be spending that cash, something that just says to you, man, I look at natural gas and it's too cheap. You should have some exposure there. Or what stands out to you when you look at the charts that you put together?
I think the things that are most interesting to me right now are probably gold stocks. I only chart one index on my site, and that's the Amex Gold Bugs Index, the HUI. But I think it's just the one that I happen to. I think somebody asked me for it one time, and so I started charting it. And I think if you look at the other gold stock indexes, you'd see they tend to follow a similar sort of a curve. And we're nearing a very low level. There's kind of was a long-term support and resistance level for these gold stocks, which was broken a while back, earlier this year. And it could still go lower. There's sort of an all-time low that we are above. We haven't gone all the way back to that. On the other hand, we're certainly down into what I would consider the bottom territory for these stocks. And recently, and just in the last few days, we've kind of had what might be a little bottoming action, but, you know, there's no way to know. But I think that the downside is somewhat limited for those, and the upside potential is tremendous. And I think you could do much better than just to buy an index like the HUI. I think if you do a little research, look at specific companies and what their management and the assets they hold in the ground and the productivity that they're getting and so forth, and, you know, do some careful picking, you could do much, much better than just buying a straight out index fund. But I think there's a lot of value there, and I think we're getting close to a real bottom there, and it's something that's investable. I mean, a lot of these things, it's more difficult to, like, I don't know what, if you say coffee or natural gas, I mean, you have, it's not very many people can afford to buy those commodities and hold them directly, so they have to wind up buying some kind of a proxy or a company that deals with them or something, and then you're adding in all kinds of other layers of complexity to your investment. But many of these things are good potentials. I mean, cocoa, coffee, as you said, there are lots of things that are near their all-time lows. The natural gas is one of the ones that I think bottomed in 2012 and seems to be making quite a strong comeback. It's been rising since then, and you know, maybe getting into a kind of a little bit of resistance area. I don't really know, but it's certainly is established itself in an uptrend. Some of these things like coffee, maybe a little bit of an uptrend, but it's in such a long-term downtrend that it's a little hard to say for sure. But I don't know how you invest exactly in those either. So one of the things I like about gold stocks is there's something you can actually research and find. You can get advice from people who are experts in them and track and follow these companies. And you're in an area, though, that's got a lot of potential, I think. Crude oil is another one of these things which is in a lowish area, but actually crude oil has been in kind of a very gentle uptrend since the 1980s. And it had a much higher levels in 2000 to 2008, and it's kind of corrected back onto into the lower part of its graph since then. But I don't know, with all the oil discoveries that are being made now in the U.S., in particular, with the new technologies that are coming online, you know, those oil prices could be declining in, you know, relative to gold. It's, again, there's no way to know, but from a fundamental point of view, I think there's good reasons to think that prices will probably stay relatively low compared to gold. Now, they may go up a lot in dollars if the world finds itself flooded with dollars it doesn't need or want, but I think compared to gold or some other objective standards of value, it's probably going to be fairly, I don't see it as a great speculation that it's going to go up a lot, as compared to something like gold stocks, which I think do have the potential to go up a lot. They've really been beaten down into a very low, low level, and many of these companies are either going to go out of business because they simply can't survive the tough climate, and they probably will. Probably many of them will. But the ones that are good, strong companies with good assets and good business models, will weather the storm, and then they'll be all the stronger coming out of it. So I think there's good potential there.
It's an awkward thing to say, on the one hand, that gold doesn't change in value, and it's the constant, and then yet we talk about gold stocks and predicate their future value and potential success on an increased value in the price of gold, which we've just defined as a constant.
Well, no, I don't think that's quite the right way to look at it. So their costs are all in dollars. And so really their success depends more on how much people want or reject dollars. You can restate anything that has to do with gold price into a dollar price. So what most people would say, well, the price of gold is rising, what that means is that the value of the dollar is falling. You can restate that the other way. And if you do, it's the same fact, then you say, wow, their costs of these companies are measured in dollars, they're declining. So the companies become more profitable because their costs are being paid in this depreciating currency. It makes it much easier for them to expand, to grow, to hire more workers, to acquire more properties and prospects to work and so forth. So their life becomes easier and their companies become more profitable. I don't know. I mean, you can sort of look at it from either way. I guess that's the thing. And it's really a mind game. It's a mindset, a mind-changing thing more than anything else, to think in terms of gold as the standard instead of the dollar as the standard. As you said earlier, it changes the lens that you look at things through. And I mean, you can say it the other way around, but I think it's not as accurate as to think of it in terms of the value of the dollar fluctuating and how does the fluctuating value of the dollar change things. So if you're an importer and you bring chocolate from Switzerland or something and sell it in the market here, it makes a big difference to you how many dollars it takes to buy a Swiss franc, because you have to purchase that chocolate, and you have to pay shipping and packing, and you have all kinds of expenses that are involved in Swiss francs. And so it makes a difference to you what the value of that currency is. And the same thing is true for a company that, like a gold mining company, it has its expenses in this foreign currency called the U.S. dollar. And its assets really are its gold. And it can deploy that, but it has costs to do that. It can market its products, and the demand for those products is going to depend a lot on the value of the currency of its customers, which is the U.S. dollar as well. So if you think of it more as an exercise in kind of international finance, even though it all may take place inside the U.S. and all be accounted on their official books in dollars, you can think about it in this inverted fashion. And I think you actually get a better picture of what's going to be happening with those companies.
It's an exercise of the mind, as you say, and it's definitely a mindset, something that has to be practiced, because, you know, following 1971 and the disposal of gold altogether from our monetary system, we have assumed a lot about the dollar, and we do this very thing. We price everything in dollar terms on the assumption that it is meaningful, and it's not as meaningful as we think it is. It would be more meaningful, as we've been discussing, to practice pricing things in gold to see what their volatility is, what their real value is, whether they're overvalued or undervalued in real money terms. When you go to pricedingold.com, is there a place that you would have people start to look at first to sort of familiarize themselves, refresh the idea, and then practice it a bit?
That's a really good question. It's something I haven't looked at. I probably need to create some pages for that purpose. Yeah, I'd probably go to the U.S. dollar page, and you know, right away you start seeing the U.S. dollar priced in gold, and that is the biggest, most stark reversal that most people are going to undergo. And then once you've sort of looked at that, take a look at some of the others. Silver is very interesting. Silver priced in gold, so it's really the silver gold silver ratio, but plotted upside down. How many grams of gold does it take to buy an ounce of silver? And so this is another thing where you see that the curve for those two is much flatter. Although, if you go back in history, it's quite interesting because the fact that this is based on the gold-silver ratio, it's probably the longest-term chart that I have on the website because there's good records for that ratio going back a long way. And let me just see. There's one that goes back to the 1700. Yeah. And so the first part of the chart is pretty flat because the governments were, again, manipulating the prices of the two things to keep them in a fairly constant ratio. But in the 1860s, the U.S. government gave that up. This is around the time of William Jennings Bryan and his Cross of Gold speech, and there was a big shift away from silver currency towards making gold the primary standard for the U.S. And at that point, silver fell in value dramatically, like fell in half. And it's kind of been pretty much a wild ride ever since then, as you know, the industrial demand for silver and the investment demand has gone back and forth, and the Hunt brothers cornered the market. All kinds of exciting stuff that's happened there. But silver prices are pretty low right now, and they've been rising gradually since, I'd say the 1990s. They've been kind of in an uptrend. At the moment, so silver is another thing that has potential for the future. I don't know that it's ever going to go back to 2 grams from the current, like, half a gram, but maybe. But I think just kind of start paging through. Look at the things that you know something about. So if you're involved in a farm operation, for example, go take a look at the farm price of wheat and priced in gold and sort of get a feeling for that. Or if you've been a longtime stock investor, you might want to take a look at some of the stock charts. If you're in another country, you might want to look at, you know, your currency priced in gold. I don't have every currency, but I have some of the major ones like the Japanese yen, the euro, the Swiss franc. I've just recently started plotting a few of the Asian currencies like the yuan and the Singapore dollar. But I'm some of the South American currencies like the Chilean peso and the Argentinian peso. And so you might take a look at those charts and see how they relate to your experience with your own currency. And then just kind of play around with it and see. So postage stamps is a really good one, actually. In the U.S., a lot of people are quite familiar with that. You know, they've kind of lived through it. And that was one of the ones that somebody asked me about, and I started charting it. And it was quite a shocker to me to see how the price of first-class stamp has changed over time. And very interesting, because for many years, it was actually a bad idea to buy forever stamps. And that was one of the things that really shocked me. You think, gosh, this would be the perfect answer to inflation, right? You buy a stamp, and now it doesn't matter how they inflate the price. You can always buy first class mail, first class letter with this forever stamp. So it's like inflation protected. It'll always be good for mailing a letter. But in actual fact, most of the time that we've had forever stamps might not have been true of the last like year, something like that. But for most of the time, the price of new stamps in gold has been falling. So buying a stamp at a higher price that's a forever stamp and then having them raise the price on the stamps, the price of gold has risen much faster than the price of stamps is rising, in effect. So you could have traded a little gold for a roll of stamps and come out ahead of purchasing the forever stamps at a lower stamp price. And that was one of the things that really kind of rocked my world. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized it has to be that way. That is it's almost a built-in feature of the way the postage service is misestablished, misrun, because they're not allowed to raise the rate, the postage rates, more than the official inflation rate. That's written into the law. So they can only raise them, and of course they're doing everything within their power to misstate the inflation rate as low as possible, which we see in many, many ways, and it's been documented by lots of other folks. So the result is that they really can't, they're not allowed to raise the prices of the stamps as much as they need to maintain parity with their costs and just the general changes in the economy. And so the result is that the forever stamps are not a good deal in terms of purchasing postage. You're actually better off to buy your postage in when you need it by trading a little bit of gold for a roll of stamps and using those. And it's that kind of thing is very counterintuitive, but it's something that that I came to from looking at this chart and thinking about what does it mean. And it's quite interesting.
You also on your site have a section where people can request charts be drawn, sort of specialized charts and whatnot.
I do. I do have a custom chart service, and anybody who comes to the website and signs up, which is free, just subscription, I'm happy to do a custom chart for them. And many of those custom charts, because I find them interesting, I go ahead and add them to the site as just part of its regular updates. Not always.
And then beyond that, that sort of one free, if they want you to do the labor for them, you're asking for some nominal remuneration for the task. And it's an interesting thing when you begin to look at investment decisions. You know, General Electric is a company that we've talked about before, not because we love it, but because it's been around a long time. And for the same reasons that you chose Yale, you can get data on it going way, way back. In 2003, when I was making that decision I described earlier, coming out of a house in Southern California, we could have looked at the equity markets and we could have looked at GE, and, you know, 100 ounces of gold would have bought, I should say $30,000 worth of cash would have bought either 100 ounces of gold or 500 shares of General Electric. And, you know, looking at that ratio was very helpful for me because, you know, today it swung about a 16 times multiple. I mean, far more than the Dow has at this point, but a 16 times gain in terms of purchasing power, gold in that time frame compared to General Electric. And clearly, owning those 500 shares of General Electric would have been a losing proposition over the last 12 years. Gold has been a winning proposition. That won't always be the same. I mean, you can't project this short period of time into an infinite future. And there will be a point at which exchanging ounces for shares makes sense. And so I think for folks to know that that service is available, if there's something particularly interesting and you want to look at the historical relationship and sort of suss out where it makes sense to be reallocating, it's a pretty valuable insight to see where you stand in the light of history and in the light of a longer-term trend. So, Charles, I just want to thank you again for joining us and for the work that you've done. I love the way you are living your life. We haven't gotten into this very much, but just a lot of time spent with family, your kids, educating them how to think well, how to engage life well, how to take risks and make decisions. The autonomy you're setting in motion, the free agency which you're empowering, I really enjoy. And I'm just an outside spectator on your life, but I see the same thing philosophically oozing into the work that you've done in PricedInGold.com, and it's appreciated. I appreciate the work that you've done and the intentionality that you bring into the life that you're living. So appreciate you being our guest, and I hope that every one of our listeners will visit the website, PricedInGold.com, spend some time adjusting their mindset and practicing seeing all the things that are of value or of potential value to them priced more accurately in real money terms. So thanks again, Charles.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, David, obviously, we can't recommend more going to his website and seeing these charts, seeing the commentary of what do things look like when they're priced in something actually that's a constant, like gold.
I mean, just to review, you assume the value of gold as a constant. There's no growth in gold, just shifting values and assets in gold terms. And if you remember to think of gold as cash, it's the same kind of pricing, you know, the things that you do today. We understand volatility of wheat in dollar terms. Mm-hmm. Yet the dollar, and every other currency for that matter, has no real moorings or intrinsic value. I mean, we're talking about paper and ink. We still understand the volatility of things like gasoline in dollar terms. We think of the U.S. dollar as a barometer for changing values of, say, the price of a home, whether it's increasing or decreasing. It's time to rethink that process and price all assets in either grams or ounces. How does an asset compare to gold through time? Just as we're conditioned to think in terms of price volatility in dollar terms, not associating volatility to the dollar, but to the items in question, this should be applied to gold instead.
Well, and David, you know, he talked about this hypnosis that we're in where we just continue to look at the dollar. I know you guys have talked about that in the past. You know, we go to the grocery store, we see everything priced in dollars, we drive down the street, we see everything priced in gasoline. Yet the problem is the dollar has lost over 90% of its value in our adult lifetimes. I think of it as drawing a ruler inches on a giant rubber band, and every time you measure something, stretching it at a different level, how in the world are you going to know the size of something? But gold is that solid ruler. It doesn't change. And if we don't change our thinking that way, we're going to be probably lost in the hypnosis.
Yeah. Things cost either more than they should and are thus expensive, or are less than they should and are value. They're cheaper than usual. And again, it represents a value. You want to retain gold ounces, your cash position, when the world is overpriced and fraught with risk, implicit risk, relative to that gold. And you want to exchange ounces when things are a compelling value, and essentially risk has been squeezed out of the equation to a large degree. That's the concept. That is the practice. That is the shift in mindset. Again, as you go to priceingold.com, just remember that it's a bit of an exercise because we are so hypnotized into this notion of dollar values of everything.
Right.
What is your net worth in gold terms? What is your house worth in gold terms? What is your car worth in gold terms? What is your grocery budget in gold terms? How much has it shifted through time? This you will begin to appreciate once it's practiced, and I would encourage you to take the time to do so. Again, I consider it a game changer where your education begins, and again, where you view stewardship of assets through a very different light, through a very different lens, something that will help you, I think, on an intergenerational basis, do it even more effectively.
Well, once again, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Charles Volum of PricedInGold.com. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.